Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, in our call to action segment, we're going to be talking with Jonathan Emord, one of the nation's leading free speech attorneys, who has a remarkable record of defeating the FDA every time they go to federal court, more than any other American attorney. We're going to talk about the FDA's denial of efficient alternative experimental drugs or therapies for terminally ill cancer patients. So if a person has been deemed terminal, why not let them use anything? Yet the FDA won't, and he will discuss why and what we can do about it. Also today, I'm going to take a look at several different important issues on the environment and also on British Petroleum. There'll be a short commentary from Greg Palast, the arrest of British Petroleum scapegoat, the real killer's walk. And also want to talk about a program I have coming up Monday evening on our Progressive Commentary Hour. We're taking on, in what will probably be a two-hour special, how America has missed everything that it should have done when it came to its war on drugs. And I'm going to take this apart piece by piece with some of the leading scholars in the world, morally, democratically, economically, and just pragmatically. All we've done is create a humongous private, profitable prison system, a security industry that has expanded. None of this has helped the people who are using the drugs nor society. We have been wrong-headed at every level, both Democrat and Republicans, so it's time that we took a look at the lies that we should be criminalizing all this and putting people in jail, which we shouldn't be. So how do we deal with it and the hypocrisy? More people die each year in the United States or injured smoking and drinking alcohol, both of which are allowed. But marijuana, they'll put you in jail for. It's just stupid. And you think that with three straight presidents, all of whom have acknowledged using drugs, that maybe they would have understood something? They didn't, because they're political animals. It's time that we just stop the nonsense, dealt honestly with this. I'll deal with that. Also, six kinds of pills Big Pharma is trying to get us hooked on for the rest of our life, from Martha Rosenberg, Alternet, and also seven diseases that Big Pharma hopes you get this year. Why? So they can save the drugs for it. We'll talk about that. Something you did not know, something that no one really knew, and that is how doctors change the names of diseases when the vaccines don't work. From Christina England from VacTruth.com, a really interesting discussion. This you won't want to miss, and I suggest that all of you who are vaccine advocates and those of you who are anti-vaccine advocates, let people know that I'm going to be dealing with this, because this is brand new information. Fully documented. I independently documented all of it because I'm doing a new documentary. Only with MDs and PhDs, all women, and women whose own children have been damaged because of the vaccines. I thought it'd be a different perspective. But then the scientists, and I'm asking a basic question to each and every scientist, each and every physician, could you please show me the proof that a vaccine, an individual vaccine or a collective group of vaccines, actually creates immunity that is protective for the particular condition? So if you're vaccinated for chickenpox or measles or hepatitis, that you're now going to be able to find in that person's blood antibodies specific, that the same as that we would create with natural immunity, that would protect that person for life. There is no such data. It does not exist. And yet the entire basis of this completely fraudulent and flawed, grossly perverse industry that is protected and profited from by pharma, governmental agencies, lobbyists, corporations, and a misguided public, is that when you're getting a vaccine, it is giving you immunity. wrong, and you'll see why today. And when my documentary comes out in the fall, it'll be the most comprehensive review yet, because I only went, that part's done, but my filming on that's done. From Brown University and all these other leading centers of immunological research, top immunologists, because there's no one better to tell you whether or not it'll work than a leading professor, chair of the Department of Immunology. Basic question, isn't it? If I get a vaccine, can I say that vaccination is immunization? Is it doing it? No. All right. Then why are we doing it? And what's the damage? Ah, that's the second part. And then we'll get into some of the cases, the people who have been adversely affected, including the women with a specific Gardasil vaccine. Anyhow, that's all coming at you. And the big one on looking at, from a completely different perspective on our whole war on drugs and the insanity of that, will be on Monday evening show. Violence. What does violence do? Now, mind you, mental violence is far more predominant in any culture than physical violence. Physical violence is when someone gets to a rageful place and can't control themselves or chooses not to control themselves and then commits some kind of physical violence. But what happens when there's just an energy, whether it's racism or sexism or whether it's just hate or anger? Here's the latest study on this, and this is from Molecular Psychiatry, the peer-reviewed journal. And this was done at Duke Institute down in Durham on the Genome and Sciences and Policy Institute. Quote, violence ages children's DNA. Now, this is from USA Today. Quote, conventional wisdom says that hardship can make us old before our time. In fact, a new study suggests that violence leaves long-term scars on children's bodies, not just in the bruises on the skin, but also altering their DNA, causing changes that are equivalent to 7 to 10 years of premature aging. Scientists measured this cellular aging by studying the ends of children's chromosomes called telomeres. And telomeres are, as this audience knows, special DNA sequences that act like the plastic tips on shoelaces, which prevent the DNA in chromosomes from unraveling. They get shorter each and every time we do something that is adverse. And hence, this is my whole concept over and over again. I'll keep saying it. Anything you do that in and of itself would seem insignificant is significant. It's just it's significant on an almost imperceptible level. It would be what happens if there's one drop of water on your forehead. Well, how about nothing? Okay. Now, what if there's 1,000 drops of water? Now 10,000, now 1,000,000. And then you simply lose consciousness with severe trauma. One French fry, one drink of alcohol, you won't notice the damage. But at a certain point in time, everything that we've done collects and it tips. And then we see something at that point. It's no different than think of all the people who are going to be basking in the sun on the beaches and intentionally not wearing sunscreen lotion just so they can get that deeper tan. If you're 16, 15, 18, you won't notice it. In your mid-20s, you will. By 30, it's really catching up. And by 40, it's tipped. You look like a sponge. Now, take a look at what we now know about violence. The energy of violence, and I believe it's on two levels. I believe that it's the actual energy that a person shares. And then I believe it's the cortisol in the recipient's body, the stress hormone that rises in order to defend the body when it's under any form of attack. And that attack may not be real in the sense of threatening the person, but the body responds as if it is, and that prematurely ages us. But then we found something else, and this goes back to a study that I did. And later, I believe another person actually replicated this study, but I did it very early, and I think 9-10 years before anyone else, where I was doing all kinds of things. I handled the anti-aging segment of the Institute of Applied Biology, but I also did the psi research, virtually all the psi research done in New York I was doing in the lab. It was like a beehive every single day of all kinds of scientists and people coming by, and we were trying things out to see if it worked. It didn't work. Most time, it didn't. I would say 99% of the time, everything we had heard or written about or promoted simply couldn't hold up to any kind of careful examination, but some did. I remember having a plant. It was a ficus plant, and there were 10 people who were selected, and each person was asked to take a piece of paper out of a box, and then on the piece of paper something was written, like a sing to the plant, or mist it, or massage the soil around the plant, or stroke the leaves of the plant gently. But one of them said, go in and yell at it and shake it. And then it was only done once, and then 2 weeks later, each person went back in, and we had, during that whole period of time, we had an EEG machine hooked up, and when that plant was shaken and yelled at, it went off the chart. 2 weeks later, each person went back in the room. Nothing happened until one person walked in, and then that machine went off the chart. Mind you, the machine, none of us knew which person had been the one who was the screamer and the shaker, because it was blinded. But the plant knew. It recognized it. How does a plant recognize someone? We're told a plant's just a plant. Wrong. Everything is energy. So there was an exchange of energy. So a person exchanged violent energy that they were giving to a plant that had just passive and loving energy. Now, there's a basic rule in homeopathy called the laws of similars. And I believe that that law applies to everything in life. So let's just put it into this context. Let's say that you're growing up and you're a little girl. You're 8 years old. You're just at that point where almost everything is processed on an unconscious level emotionally, and you really haven't got to where you're processing it in any meaningful way on an intellectual level. In other words, you can't understand why people act the way they do towards you, either demeaning or threatening or pulling away. You just absorb it. Now we know, based upon the new sciences of epigenetics, that we become the totality of the environment that we're in. Hence, if we're around loving and kind and upbeat and positive and thoughtful and humorous parents, that absolutely vibrates our genes and therefore encodes within our genes a longer life, because the happier you are, the healthier you are. But let's say we didn't have that kind of upbringing. Instead, we had people who were argumentative or dismissive or weren't able to give us what we needed in the way of acceptance. That also is perceived, and that's a negative energy, and that vibrates differently, and that impacts the gene. So now let's say nothing more happens, and we grow up, we go to school, we get degrees, we do well in what we do, but we keep self-sabotaging relationships, we say things we shouldn't, and then later apologize, or we think, why did I do that? That was stupid. It's because of what this is showing. What this article just published in the peer-reviewed journal Molecular Psychiatry shows. Violence ages children's DNA. Well, how does it age it? What actually happens? An energy exchange. It's not a physical energy. It's the energy that you project. That energy is what everyone in this audience knows. How many times have you thought about someone and they called? Or you knew something was happening, even though you shouldn't have known? There was no reason to know, but you knew. That's, and especially among mothers with their children, you know, you have that feeling. That's nature's gift. That's intuition. And when you master intuition, then suddenly a whole lot opens up for you. But it's also true, remember, you can't have half of an equation without understanding the other half. So you can't say thinking good thoughts creates good emotions and good energy, which you can then share with other people and have good experiences and good feedback loop without having its opposite. You can't say eating healthy foods and drinking good juices, healthy juices, produces good DNA and good enzyme levels and good pH and good alkalinity without having its opposite. You can't say that there is good without there is bad. You can't have half an equation, even though politically or philosophically or ideologically we almost always reject our opposite. We don't want to go there. And yet I did a whole documentary on this called Overcoming the Dark Side, and then another one on overcoming addictive behavior. I was able to help people overcome addictive behavior only when they finally recognized how powerful those negative energies were, those repetitive, unconscious, subconscious, toxic energies, because that was also present along with the good energy. And at any given moment, a person could choose one or the other. So just remember, anytime you say something to someone, anytime you write something or text them or leave a voice message, anything, that, if it's negative, it's a form of emotional violence. And now we have the science to back that up, and that's why people who are trying to hold relationships together where there's someone abusive in the relationship and you act like a doormat or a sponge, that's why you age prematurely, you sicken quicker, you'll have stress-related illnesses, itises in particular, Crohn's disease, ileitis, you know, colitis, diverticulitis, ulcers. All these things are stress-related. Arthritis is stress-related. But we never could see it. It wasn't something linear. It wasn't reductionistic. It wasn't say this thought, end up with this disease. Eat this hamburger, end up with obesity. Drink this and end up with liver cirrhosis. Life is far more complex than that. And yet we view supercilious, mind-numbingly stupid arguments to justify that it couldn't have been that bad. How do you know? How do you know when that one drink will tip and then you end up with a diseased liver? How do you know when that one sandwich will end up causing your stroke? How do you know when that one more negative statement ends a relationship? You won't until you do it. And almost always people become oblivious of the significance of their emotional violence. And one of the things that you should pay attention to in this life is you have a choice. Be around people who are emotionally violent or not. But now you know you're going to pay a price. Not just for the person, but the entire environment. That's why creating working environments and social environments that are positive and uplifting, inspiring and motivating is so much needed in our society. And yet we have a lot of people that congregate to negative and toxic environments where they can project their victimhood and everybody is blaming someone and everyone's angry. Well, boy, you talk about some negative effects upon your telomeres. That's it. So now they're saying 10 years off your life. Berries keep the brain sharp. This is a new study and a good study from the American Neurological Association and Child Neurological Society, published in the Annals of Neurology. Here's what it says. And I'm giving you this because this is real. This is ultra-Orthodox mainstream saying this from Brigham and Women's Hospital. Berries, quote, are good for you. That's no secret, but can strawberries and blueberries actually keep your brain sharp in old age? A new study by researchers at Brigham and Young Women's Hospital finds that a high intake of flavonoid-rich berries, like blueberries and strawberries, over time can delay memory decline in women substantially. Quote, what makes our study unique is the amount of data we analyzed over such a long period of time. No other berry study has been conducted on such a large scale. Among women who consumed two or more servings of strawberries and blueberries each week, we saw a reduction in memory decline. The effect appears to be attainable with relatively simple dietary modification. And they studied 121,000 women, nurses, in this study. Okay, they said that this is important and it's revolutionary to them. Gee whiz, how many of the people in this audience are waking up each day and having your berries in fresh, frozen, concentrate, or powders? And not just strawberries and blueberries, but a whole lot of berries. Well, how much good is that doing your brain? If two servings of strawberries a week, and a serving's a cup, is helping them delay brain aging and memory loss by almost 3 years, imagine what it's doing for you at the level you're taking it in. 10, 15 years? And you've been doing it for a long time. One final issue, building muscle without heavy weights. Now, what we know is, and this is from Applied Physiology, Nutrition, and Metabolism, weight training at lower intensity but with more repetitions is as effective for body muscle building as lifting heavy weights. That's the newest study, and that's good. So let's say that you have, a 40-pound barbell and a dumbbell, and you're curling it, and it's really hard, so you can curl it 5 times. What this study is showing is, if you had a 15-pound barbell and you curled it 30 times, you're getting the same benefit. Lower weight, higher reps, same outcome. This was done at McMaster University, conducted a series of studies, so that's good. Quote, their conclusion, bigger weights may not beget bigger muscles. Evidence from acute muscle proteins and synthetic responses after resistance exercise showed. So that's good. Oh, and by the way, some people are not using white potatoes because you were told that it leads to obesity and type 2 diabetes. Well, this study shows that's not true. It shows, in fact, done by the Federation of American Society of Experimental Biology, that white potatoes, baked or boiled or mashed, is not associated with obesity or type 2 diabetes or increase in C-reactive protein, a marker which we know is of systemic inflammation, which is dangerous. It's what you put on them that causes the difference, and it's how you fry them. If you fry them, yes. Hence, French fries are bad. So continue having your potatoes. They're good for you. And they're extra good if you put some, for example, always heat a potato by, and that this includes even boiling potato, by massaging it first in coconut oil. Because that protects the nutrients in the skin from heat degradation when you're cooking it. And this idea that you have to bake a potato at high temperature, just the opposite. You bake a potato at let's say, 400 degrees, you end up with a baked potato, but if you notice, when you open it up, it's still not completely cooked on the inside. It's hard, but it's burnt on the outside, and the skin is just like leather. Try it at 275 degrees. First massaging it in coconut oil and put it on the middle shelf, not near the flame at the top or the bottom, or a confection of them where the air circulates, you'll find that your potato is cooked evenly throughout, not overcooked, and it's overcooked, by the way, when it's watery. It's fluffy, and the skin is still edible because it hasn't been overheated, creating acrylamides. That's the right way of eating a potato. And then if you really want to juice it up, take a half a cup of sweet raw onions, rinse them under water after you dice them. Then take some shiitake mushrooms, about a cup, and you lightly saute, and with some cayenne pepper. And then some extra virgin organic olive oil. And then open up the potato and put the olive oil, shiitake mushroom, and the raw onions. That's a delicious dish. It's got alpha-lipoic acid, complete protein, and it's wonderful for you. So one more thing, now we dispelled some myths there, and that's good. I'm Gary Noll. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. Got a lot to share today, and I'm going to go to our environmental segment now, and then we're going to open up for calls in a moment or two. And I've got one issue before we go to that. First, Dartmouth University scientists, and this is from Dartmouth College, track radioactive iodine from Japan nuclear reactor meltdown. Quote, radioactive iodine found by Dartmouth researchers in the local New Hampshire environment is a direct consequence of a nuclear reactor's explosion and meltdown half a world away. That's according to the research director of the Department of Earth Science. the failure of the Fukushima nuclear power facility and earthquake and tsunami was the largest nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. And it talks about how now that's being blown all over the place, and they're finding it. Now, why is this important? First, because it's still releasing massive amounts of radiation every second of the day. Secondly, because there's that very weakened building number 4 that holds the largest amount of the spent fuel rods up in the air. If there's an earthquake, before they're able to get all those spent fuel rods safely removed, then that would be the largest catastrophic event since the dinosaurs' extinction. You wouldn't have a safe place to live anywhere in that area of the world, and it would also severely contaminate much of the United States. I think that that should be a national effort by all governments of the world to bring their leading scientists in there and everyone work together to protect that building number 4 and get it to where they can decommission it. But no one's doing that. So I just want to bring that to your attention. Also, here's something you need to know about the tar sands from Ben Jervey from the Smog blog. Quote, think that dirtiest oil on the planet is only found up in Alberta? You might be surprised to hear that there are tar sand deposits in Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming, much of which are on public lands. And while none of the American tar sands deposits are actively being developed yet, energy companies are frantically working to raise funds, secure approvals, and start extracting. And then it goes on to talk about the Bureau of Land Management estimates there are about 19 billion barrels of tar sand oils, mostly in eastern Utah, and though most of that would not be recoverable. And then it has maps, and I was looking at all these maps. So now, here's the deal. So we have an enormous amount of tar sands right here in the United States. And it was right out there where President Obama was campaigning and going to allow the transport to go from Colorado down to Texas. And I was thinking, why there? Why would you only implement half of a pipeline, knowing the other half would meet with an environmental firestorm? Because no one knew that the real gimmick is this, and you haven't heard this before. There's an enormous amount of pressure being brought to bear by LA corporations and by lobbyists to get our common land, our forest, our ranges and plains opened up so that these people can go in, these companies, and mine it. And then they don't have to go from Canada, Alberta down. They can go from Utah and Wyoming and Colorado, all of which intersect each other, right straight down. And they already have the pipeline in place, and so that's what this is all about. So watch this in move. You'll see this happening in the near future. Our effort should be keep common lands, public lands, national parks off limits to that kind of drilling. And also, this came in from The Guardian. And needless to say, we didn't hear this anywhere in the United States. And by the way, this is by a Nobel Prize-winning biologist, Sir John Sulston, given and promoted by the Royal Academy in England. That's the equivalent to our National Academy of Sciences. Quote, world population needs to be stabilized quickly and high consumption in rich countries rapidly reduced to avoid, quote, a downward spiral of economic and environmental ills. This is from the Royal Society. Contraception must be offered to all women who want it, and consumption must be dramatically reduced. And this is the latest article on this. Otherwise, in the very near future, we're going to be facing some, quote, disasters. So we got to pay attention, those of us who choose to get off the grid and stay off. And there are many other places in the world that we can have a quality of life without living in these cities. And last here from Greg Pallast from Nation of Change. Today, Justice Department arrested former BP engineer Kurt Mix for destroying evidence in the Deepwater Horizon blowout. I once ran a Justice Department racketeering case, and damned if I would have cuffed some poor schmuck like Mix, especially when there's hot smoking guns showing greater crimes by British Petroleum higher-ups. Last week, I released evidence. We uncovered that British Petroleum top executives concealed evidence of a prior blowout. Had they not covered up the 2008 blowout and then the Caspian Sea, then the Deepwater Horizon probably would not have blown out 2 years later in 2010. I urge you to read the affidavit of FBI agent Barbara O'Donnell, which the government filed in arresting Mix. His crime is deleting texts from his phone indicating that the blown out Meconia well was gushing over 15,000 barrels a day, not 5,000, as British Petroleum told the public and government. If true, it's a crime, destruction of evidence. But Mix is a minnow. What about the sharks? The texts were obviously sent to someone, a supervisor. If supervisors knew, then undoubtedly so did British Petroleum managers higher up. Presumably even CEO Tony Hayward would have gotten the message on his racing yacht. Destruction of evidence is not nice, but concealment of evidence and fraud by corporate bigs is the bigger crime. So he says, I demand that we find out what supervisors knew and when they knew it and didn't tell us. I think that's reasonable. Otherwise, you just get one small pawn. And finally, this is from Christina England from VacTruth.com. It's entitled, Doctors Change Names of Diseases When Vaccines Don't Work. It's not long, but it's important. And then I'll open up the lines, and then we'll hear from you and Luann Panessi, who has your emails, and Jonathan Emord, our newsmaker update in a little bit. And by the way, remember, a lot of you are listening over the telephone, and we're approaching a million minutes of people listening, so a lot of people are listening over the phone. You can, too, anywhere in the United States or Canada, 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. When vaccines do not work, the creative way to cover it up is to change the name of the disease. Doctors around the world are being faced with children catching the diseases they've been vaccinated against. Rather than diagnosing these children correctly, professionals have discovered that the doctors are giving the diseases new names. This suggests a cover-up is going on, and the vaccinations we are all being told are safe and effective are, in fact, completely useless. Vaccinations are now being given to children to keep them safe from every disease known. There appears to be a vaccination for everything from polio to a broken fingernail. However, many professionals now believe that the vaccinations are actually causing the diseases they are supposed to prevent. It appears that they could be right because news has just been released that 47,000 children became paralyzed after polio vaccinations in India this last year. According to Dr. Jacob, a member of the National Technical Advisory Group on Immunizations and of the Working Group on the Food and Drug Administration, in 2011, after receiving the polio vaccine, an additional 47,500 children were newly paralyzed, over and above the standard rate of 2 per children per 100,000 non-polio. Dr. Vera Schreibner is a professional who would not be at all surprised at the above figures. She has firmly believed for many years that contrary to the belief that vaccinations prevent children from becoming ill, they are causing children to catch the diseases that they are being vaccinated against. So here's this whole report showing that those who were given the polio vaccine actually came down with the polio vaccine in large numbers. And that's just the beginning of a whole article. You can read the complete article on my website. Back in a moment with your calls. Please stay with us. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888.
Understand my ups and downs, and there you were.
Happy Race, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to be taking your calls now and going to a newsmaker update with Jonathan Nemore in a few moments. Just to put a dot on this, if you think this is something new, where 47,000 children develop in one study, develop polio after being given the vaccine, it goes way back. This is from the British Medical Journal, and it says the following: polio eradication, a complex in-game polio eradication by vaccination. She said, Anderson et al., poliomyelitis occurring after antigen injections in pediatrics, page 741, wrote, during the last year, several investigators have reported that occurrence of poliomyelitis after a few weeks after injection of the antigen. Martin in England noted 25 cases in which paralysis of a single limb occurred within 28 days of injection of antigen into that limb, and cases following penicillin injections. By the way, when was that? 1951. Now, here's something from 1949. Quote, Geffen, studying the 1949 poliomyelitis cases in London, observed 30 patients who had received an antigen within 4 weeks, noting also that the paralysis involved especially the extremity into which the injection had been given. So, in other words, wherever they injected, in the arm, the leg, that became paralyzed. That's 1949, and that's 30 cases, and there are many others. In 1954, during testing, Dr. Bernice Eddy became very concerned after vaccinating 18 monkeys with the inactivated polio vaccine. She discovered that the vaccine was causing the monkeys to become paralyzed. She wrote, quote, we had 18 monkeys. We inoculated these 18 monkeys with each vaccine that came in, and we started getting paralyzed monkeys in all of them, end quote. Well, alarmed, she immediately informed her superiors, sending photos of the monkeys instead of the thanks she had expected, and the immediate halt of the vaccine program. A surprising thing happened. William Sebrell, the director of the National Institutes of Health, stopped by the animal house where they were working, not to thank her for blowing the whistle, but to ask her if she and her co-workers wanted their children immunized with that same vaccine as it was in short supply. Needless to say, neither she nor her researchers thought the vaccine was worth the risk. And shortly after her discovery, a study written by Peterson et al. Appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association magazine. Peterson also spoke about the vaccine-induced poliomyelitis, this time in Idaho, during the trial of the Salk injectable vaccine. The study was included as part of Dr. Schreibner's research in a letter to the British Medical Journal. So here we had it. The people getting the polio were people getting the vaccine, and even in monkeys. Did they do anything about it? No, they did not. And there's probably 70 separate scientific reports on this that I have. By the way, for those of you who didn't hear yesterday, there's a new research out where they now have liquid solar cells that you can paint onto surfaces. Quote from Science Daily, scientists at University of Southern California have developed a potential pathway to cheap, stable solar cells made from nanocrystals so small they can exist as a liquid ink and be painted or printed onto clear surfaces. The solar nanocrystals are about 4 nanometers in size, meaning you could fit more than 250 billion on the pin of a head of a pin, and float them in a liquid solution. Like you print a newspaper, you can print solar cells. What this means is that you could put solar paint all over your house and or anything else on the surface. That's good news also. Let's take a call and say hello to Paul from Staten Island. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Yeah, Gary. We have to re-examine every single policy that they're putting out today. It seems like their biggest intention is profit. But the idea of putting people in jail on this so-called war on drugs, I think a lot of this war on drugs is about profiting and money for those in the connection. And putting people in jail for that is actually, it's beyond comprehension, spiritually and morally.
you're starting off with two assumptions. You're starting off the assumption that those people who support putting people in jail for long sentences for using marijuana are both moral and spiritual, and I would suggest neither is the case. And they're also they're not the brightest people that we have, but they are amongst the most powerful. And you always have to ask, who benefits from this? Does society become a safer place? Is it good for the person? No. But we're going to explore that in depth on my Monday evening, 7 o'clock Progressive Commentary Hour show. You won't want to miss that. And I have a judge who's going to be on the program, a sitting judge right now, talking about this. Let's say hello to Steve from Queens. Hi, Steve.
Gary, thanks for taking my call. Two quick points, questions. One, I'm going to put up a little garden in the front there. I'm kind of confused with what to plant right now in terms of vegetables with the weather. But, you know, it rains one day, it rains, doesn't rain the next day. So I was wondering if you had an idea of what's good to plant right now with the chaotic weather. And my second question is about...
Let me focus on that then. It depends upon the soil that you have. If you have a loose, loamy soil, a sandy soil, it doesn't matter what you plant because it'll drain. If you have a clay cap right underneath the soil, it does because the water will accumulate and rot the rot the roots and the villi, which will then stunt the crop and then it'll turn brown on you. Also, you can overcome that if you dig down to the hard soil or the rock and put in some looser soil and mix it with some, high fibrous material like straw that is biodegrading down, because then that acts as a sponge in between, and that's what allows the water to go through. And otherwise, right now, you can plant just about anything because we're out of the bad weather and you're not going to have frost and you're not going to have anything that would be adverse, okay? All the best to you.
And my next point is raw honey. If you're a diabetic or if you're trying to control your sugar level, is raw honey okay to use if you're trying to save from sugar?
If you have a small amount of raw honey in a glass of tea, let's say like a quarter teaspoon, that will not adversely affect your blood sugar level. And make sure that it's raw, unfiltered honey. No, that's not going to do anything negative. All right, all the best to you.
Thank you.
Before we go to our guest, Jonathan Emord, standing by to talk about the FDA's denial of effective alternative cancer therapies to terminally ill patients and yet continue to promote really bankrupt therapies for terminal patients. We're going to go to him in a moment. Let's go into our studio. And I'm told that we have both Luann on the line and in studio in New York City. We also have Valerie, one of our executive producers. Hi, Val.
Hey, Gary. I just have some good news for you. I want you to know that your documentary, Knocking on the Devil's Door, Our Deadly Nuclear Legacy, just won the Gold Remy Award for the best documentary in the World Fest Houston Film Festival, one of the most prestigious awards in independent filmmaking. And it's a great honor to win one of these Festival Remy Awards. There were over 4,500 entries in all the categories in that festival, and you won. So congratulations. And also, Knocking on the Devil's Door, Our Deadly Nuclear Legacy, and your newest film, The American Veterans Discarded and Forgotten, are both in competition at the Hoboken Film Festival that's coming up in June, the first week of June. So anyone in the audience who would like to go and see those films, just check out on the web the Hoboken Film Festival for the actual dates they're going to be shown. They haven't been announced yet, but please, I urge everyone to go and see them because they're both great films.
Well, they have a lot of good films at the International Film Festival in Hoboken. It's one of the most respected film festivals in the world. I'm there during the first 2 weeks of June, so I will be there. I look forward to it. Thank you, Val.
Thank you.
And it's Valerie and Richie and Richard Polineski and our whole editing and producing staff that take what I film out in where I'm at now and put it into those award-winning films. And without them, that wouldn't happen, so I thank all of them. Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hi, Gary.
Wait one second. Luann, I was just told we have a call from London. Anna?
Okay.
Anna, you're on.
Hello.
Hi, Anna.
Hello, yes. I have a question here concerning histamine. I was wondering if you had any advice on which foods to eat to control the high histamine levels, which are causing a lot of reactions, allergic reactions.
Sure. The best antihistamine approach is actually vitamin C with quercetin. The more quercetin, the better the antihistamine impact. 2,000 to 4,000 milligrams a day of quercetin and 5,000 to 10,000 milligrams a day of vitamin C. Also, your berries and berry juices, pomegranate juice, tart cherry and tart cherry juice, and celery and cucumber juice. All those are good. All the best to you, and thank you for listening over there in London.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Bye. Over to you, Luann.
Hi, Gary. It's always fun to get listeners from across the lake. I have an email here from Joseph from Connecticut, and a very interesting question. He said, here in the United States, people are struggling to just get through the day. There's a lot more stress because of economic pressures. And he says, why should we be concerned about what's happening in Europe?
Why? Because Europe is the third largest economy in the world behind the United States and China. And China has a major export to the European countries. So if the European countries are not buying from China, and China has to rely more upon other nations or to its own internal country sales, then what's the likelihood that China will continue to give money to America, to the United States, and to bail it out? I don't see that happening in the next year or two in any case, the way it has in the past. But also think of all the products and services that are done in the United States for the European countries. So if the European Union is in trouble, we had better pay attention because we're connected to it. And look right now, Spain is in a deep recession. And today it was just announced that Britain is in a deep recession. But how about Belgium, the Netherlands, Czech Republic, and Italy? You add those all together along with Greece, you're dealing with at least $6 trillion that they can't meet and pay. So what are they doing? The worst thing that they should do. They're cutting back pensions. They're cutting back welfare. They're cutting back educational grants. They're cutting back things that allow the average person in those countries to go out and have some money and buy something. When you have money in a high-end corporate hand, it generally travels about six times. When you have it in a low-end hand, it travels up to 70 times. Now, what do I mean? If we supported small business people in Europe, and collectives in Europe. Let's say we took a bunch of unemployed people in England and we helped them in England, if you were in England, help them open up their own business, which they were responsible for. They had to do their own work and they had to support themselves, but there was a way to bring them together. Each time they made a dollar, they're going to buy something with it, buy food in a local store, go to a local movie, get some cleaning materials, whatever. Buy a shirt. It travels around. It circulates from hand to hand. In the United States, the same is true. I've gone into rust belts, and in these rust belts, you'll see very few things open. The vast majority of stores are closed. So how many times can a dollar change hands? Well, what should you do? Give a major bureaucracy more money to waste and give to its favored insider corporations? Absolutely not. Give it to the military-industrial complex? It'd be a waste. Instead, we should be supporting no-interest loans to small businesses that qualify in every small community in the United States, providing that that loan also ensures a living wage for people that they hire. Therefore, where you had 10 closed businesses on a main street, you can open up four of them. And now those four have to have employees, and that they work at a living wage. And then that money is circulated, and they pay sales taxes, and they pay other taxes, which then help raise the standard. That's what we're not doing. Cutting our way out of a $6 trillion deficit in Europe will not work, and cutting our way through an austerity program of $16 trillion in the United States will not work. You have to put people to work. We're doing just the opposite, and that is why it's failing. And that's why you better pay attention, because what happens in Europe is coming here. Okay?
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. Let's go over and say hello for a newsmaker, short newsmaker piece to my guest standing by, Jonathan Emord. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Jonathan is one of the nation's leading free speech attorneys who has remarkably defeated the Food and Drug Administration in federal court more than any other American attorney, earning him the title of the FDA Dragon Slayer. In fact, he received the Cancer Control Society's Humanitarian Award for winning and preserving our great civil rights to life, liberty, and health freedoms. And he is the author of several critically acclaimed books, including The Rise of Tyranny and Global Censorship of Health Information. Nice to have you with us today, Jonathan.
Good to be with you, Gary.
Jonathan, this is just a short piece, but to inform people, when someone is terminally ill, they just on ethical basis, they should have the right to select whatever therapy they want, and yet the FDA has done everything possible to prevent terminally ill people or their caregivers from even knowing that these therapies exist and continue to support therapies that are long ago bankrupt for helping people. Tell us what the FDA is doing in its denial of effective alternative experimental therapies for terminally ill patients.
Well, in the typical course, a person who's diagnosed with cancer will in almost every instance be given radiation and chemotherapy. And according to national statistics on this, there's virtually no change in their longevity. They'll die at roughly the same time they would predictably die from the cancer itself, or even a shorter period, with the chemotherapy and the radiation. So in incurable cancers, these two treatments are inefficacious. Yet the government and the medical establishment really does expect cancer patients to rely on these two treatment modalities. Invariably, they will come to the end of the line when those treatments have been established in their case not to be effective, and then they'll want alternatives. It's precisely at that juncture when they realize that they do not have the freedom to choose the treatment of their choice, even when fully informed, executing an informed consent, even when the sponsor of the drug wishes to make it available, the FDA has to be convinced. And so the FDA makes the life-deciding decision, hope-affecting decision for the patient and for the clinical trial organization. And that oftentimes leads, when the clinical trial organization is not a major pharmaceutical company, to a negative decision. That is, you may not have the treatment of your choice, despite the fact that you have been given a death sentence by your physicians, and that you must go back, if at all, to the failed treatments. And this has happened over and over again, most recently with a client of mine, Pat Clarkson, who has multiple myeloma. She wanted to gain access to Dr. Brzezinski's anti-neoplastins, and he was willing to provide it to her, but the FDA said no, without explanation, just said no.
Why aren't we more concerned about what the federal agencies and bureaucracies are doing to take more control over our lives?
Good question. I think most people find it hard to believe that when they need their freedom the most, when they're dying of a terminal illness and they need the freedom to choose something because nothing conventionally works, they're denied that freedom. And that's the horrific reality. And yet so many people are willing to live day to day without challenging this because they simply don't. It's too far off. They don't wish to preoccupy themselves with that negative information. But I tell you, we really must. And fortunately for us all, the Alliance for Natural Health, which I represent, wants me to petition the FDA to change the rules to allow greater access for terminally ill patients. And they're going to spearhead that campaign. Anyone interested in helping should contact ANH-USA.org. And by the way, they're looking for people who have been denied access. So if you've been denied access, if you have experienced this, where the FDA has denied access for you or for a family member who may even have died as a result, we want to hear from you. So I would recommend you contact Gretchen Dubow, who's the head of the ANH USA, at gretchen@anh-usa.org. We're gathering as many people as possible together to form a basis to proceed against the agency. We're going to start with a petition to the agency on behalf of all those wrongfully denied access to cancer treatments.
Good for you. For those of you who are saying goodbye to us now, you're listening to Jonathan Emord. Jonathan, give me your email address, please.
jemord@emord.com.
That's E-M-O-R-D. For those of you who can stick around, we have another 5 minutes. I'm going to be asking Jonathan Emord some questions about the power of bureaucracies over our lives. Jonathan, I've been promoting alternative cancer therapies for people from the beginning right through to the end of their cancer therapy, whenever they choose to get on board and try it. And I've tried to separate out those that actually have credibility in their outcomes, you know, like Dr. Issels and Brzezinski, Rivisi, Livingston Wheeler, Alcotti, Burton, and Gerson. These people have hard evidence that they've been able to help people who are diagnosed as terminally ill, and 5 years later they're alive and well. And yet, consistently, no agency that's officially designated as an information agency on cancer, the National Cancer Institute, the U.S. Public Health Service, the FDA, or even the independent private American Cancer Society, no one wants to acknowledge that any of these therapies have any basis at all. After all the thousands and thousands of patients who've been helped, and there's hard evidence that, testimony before Congress, articles written, a special on 60 Minutes in 2020. So I cannot believe that they're saying no to alternative therapies because there's a lack of evidence or a lack of interest. I have to believe that it is highly political because of what could be lost to the pharmaceutical companies providing very toxic chemotherapy or to the radiologists if it was found that you didn't need those and had equal or better chance of surviving and quality of life, however long you survive, if you chose an alternative therapy. What are your thoughts on that, please?
Well, it is very much a protectionist regime that FDA operates with the blessing of Congress, and that is that FDA, there's an enormous industry that has FDA-approved drugs for the treatment of cancer, and they have an enormous financial stake in ensuring that those drugs remain available and, likewise, ensuring that drugs that compete with those remain unavailable. So the only parties that can crack into this universe are the ones who are the large pharmaceutical companies themselves. Yet innovation in cancer care is oftentimes coming from single practitioners, scientists operating away, finding something unique, and then discovering, as Brzezinski did, that this has particular application in tissue-based tumors and seems to be working. Yet when a person, you know, just imagine, when your life is at stake, there's no one on earth who has a greater interest or need in deciding what is best for you than you. And you have a keen interest in evaluating what those options are available and discussing it with professionals and coming up with a determination that's informed and then making an informed choice. Well, even when there is absolute evidence that you're an adult, that you're intelligent, that you can make an informed choice, that your doctors agree with the choice, the FDA comes in and says no. Well, that interferes with the practice of medicine. That interferes with freedom of choice, most importantly. After all, who's going to suffer the consequence of a wrong decision? Just you. You are. And who's going to say that the decision is wrong? No one. Why? Because you can't prove it to be wrong based on any available evidence. It's experimental by definition. Therefore, the person with the most interest, the one who has the disease himself or herself, should have the freedom to choose the direction to take in his or her own struggle for survival, and everyone else should get out of the way. Now, if there are instances of fraud going on, and there are, go get them. FDA, Justice Department, go get these people. But when you've got an FDA-approved clinical trial underway, and you're denying access to people to that, simply because you're favoring FDA traditionally approved drugs and licensees, large drug companies trying to avoid any potential for competition. This is outrageous that a government would serve a private economic interest at the expense of human life.
Jonathan, we're out of time, but let us continue this in a different direction the next time you're on at length, not just a Newsmaker short piece. You've been in Washington a long time. I'd like to talk to you about bloated bureaucracies that interfere in our life and do not enhance the quality of our freedoms or our country. That's a discussion I believe that you could give us a lot of insight on.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Jonathan Emord, E-M-O-R-D, author of The Rise of Tyranny. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. And Sunday night, 8 p.m., Talk Back, my one-hour health nutrition program. Been doing it for 35 years. Look forward to having you then. Have a nice day. Stay tuned for Danny Schechter, the News Dissector, coming up in 1 minute.